Well, welcome back. I hope you had an enjoyable time listening to one of the two research presentations that just happened, and hopefully you got something informative out of that. This panel is something we've been doing for the 3 years of the conference in the last slot on Friday afternoon, and it's the Clubhouse Confidential panel. Clubhouse Confidential, as I'm sure most of you know, is MLB Network's show, or maybe I should say more accurately, Brian Kenny's show on baseball analytics. And I think a lot of people who I've talked to would suggest that this show has done a lot in terms of advancing the cause of analytics, both inside the game to baseball insiders as well as outside the game. And you know, before we start, I just want to acknowledge our one representative from the Clubhouse crew here this year, Micah Karg. Would you stand up, Micah? You know, the producers often stay a bit in the background, and when you work on the show as often as the four of us have up here, you realize how much of an impact a producer really has. It's not just the folks you see at the other end, although I don't want to get into an argument with Brian about this topic, okay? But basically, the producers really do have a huge impact on the show. And Micah this year took almost the entire load of the show himself, when in past years it's been shuffled between producers off and on throughout the year, a team of two, three, four producers. So I know we all appreciate the work that Micah has done this year to sort of keep us in line and help us hopefully deliver some good content on air. So anyway, I think you know our panel, but I'd like to introduce it, if you don't mind. We have to my right here, Baseball Prospectus Chief Editor Ben Lindbergh. Sitting next to him is Fangraphs. I don't know if you've ever been called Fangraphs' version of Ben Lindbergh. Have you ever been called that before?
I don't. I think we should call him Baseball Prospectus' version of me.
Okay. Anyway, Dave Cameron. We're happy to have Dave back. And at the end of the table here, we have our good longtime friend, Rob Nyer. This time, Rob has a different employer than he had the last time we saw him here, and he's with Fox Sports. So welcome, Rob. So what we'd like to do for the next hour is we'll tee up some topics and bat them around up here and give you some perspectives from our standpoint. But we hope to have, and hope you'll help us have, a longer than natural Q&A in this process. So we're not going to go we don't intend to go 45 minutes in a 15-minute Q&A. We'd like to see that a little bit more balanced and get your, this is a good opportunity to get some feedback from you. What do you want to discuss? What do you want to hear opinions on? And we'll go back and forth with it. But let's start off with this question. Something that any baseball fan who thinks about the game and watches the game has thought about a lot the last 4 months, which is, what about the moves made this offseason by teams? And so what I'd like to do is toss it to Ben to start and ask Ben what he thinks was the best move, or the flip side of that would be the worst move for the other team, perhaps, of the offseason. Ben?
Well, we ran at Baseball Prospectus the last couple of weeks. We picked our favorite and least favorite moves, and I actually found it much easier this time to come up with moves that I did like. I don't know whether that's because teams are getting smarter or we're getting more mellow or what it is, but I think I would start off maybe with some moves that the Royals made. If anything, just because they've gotten so much grief from people like us over the years. Certainly, if we were talking about this last year, they would probably not be mentioned as favorite moves. But the things that they did kind of, you know, if you look at, they went into last season with Chris Getz at second base and Jeff Francoeur at right field. Both really, really good guys, good-looking guys. Not the best at baseball, it seems. If you look at, you know, over the past 3 years, second base for the Royals has been the least productive position on any team. If you go back 4 years, I think Mariners DHs take the crown, as Dave could vouch for.
They have so many of them, too.
So if you replace a guy like Goetz with a guy like Omar Infante, or, you know, you replace Francoeur with Nori Aoki, I thought both of those moves were really smart. I like both of those players. You know, they gave up a pretty good pitcher in Will Smith, but I think for a team in the Royals' position that is defensible, I think it makes sense. So I thought those were big upgrades for them, and it's, you know, it's hard to come up with anything they did that I really disliked. I thought they had a lot of holes to fill, and I thought they filled them pretty effectively.
Well, I'll take the very obvious one that Ben did not take, and I will take the Nationals stealing Doug Fister from everyone else in Major League Baseball. I think that's the trade that, now that Doug Fister's elbow hurts, we're like, oh, maybe Dave Dombrowski like pulled the wool over on everyone's eyes. But I think that's the trade that all offseason made the least sense. I think it was the trade that when we heard what the Tigers were getting back, was a head-scratcher, even for people in baseball that I was talking with after the trade was announced. Teams were a little annoyed. They were like, we could have done better than that, and we weren't given the chance to do better than that. I think for Doug Fister, no matter how you evaluate pitching, whether it's FIP or ERA or tallness, I mean, it doesn't really matter. Doug Fister's a top 10 Major League pitcher over the last 3 years, and no one seems to care. This is the second time he's been traded for a bag of balls. So Doug Fister, underrated, very good. Hope his elbow stays on. He's awesome. Good job, Nationals.
First of all, I agree with both. Basically, those are the answers I would have given if I had gone first or second. Basically, in most years. I do like what the Royals have done. They had some obvious needs, and they addressed them as reasonably as they probably could have. I don't know if any of those players they got are going to be really good in 3 years, but they needed to get better this year, and they did. And they'll be fun to watch for the first time in a long time. They were really fun in the second half last year, actually. Before I talk about Fister, who I wrote about a couple of weeks ago, I'll give you a short little window into my work life. I always have a notebook handy, and I'm always running across quotes about various subjects, many of which, in my mind anyway, apply to baseball somehow. And I write them down thinking, this would be great to use in a piece someday, or even better, mention in conversation and sound really, really smart. You know those people who always have the quote just pop right out? And I never do it, because I don't remember them. What I did do last week, though, is I took a picture of different pages in my notebook. So here's a quote for you. This does relate, I promise. This is Voltaire. Uncertainty is an uncomfortable position, but certainty is an absurd one. And that struck me when it came to Doug Fister, because I had initially exactly the same take that Dave did. And then as time goes along, you start asking other questions. Dave's right. Doug Fister is certainly been underrated. But is he underrated by all the smart teams, too? Why didn't one of those jump on this? Now, the answer that we've heard, or that we heard at the time, was that all the teams didn't know he was available. Dave Dombrowski denies that, as he probably would, because if he doesn't deny it, he looks foolish. But maybe there are things we don't know. And I meant to do some research today. I think Doug Fister's had some injury issues.
He's got some sore elbow.
Has he even pitched this spring?
He's got like 2 innings he's pitching on Sunday.
So we'll see. We might look back at this deal in a few months or a year and say, maybe it wasn't that awful. I tend to side with Dave. I mean, just on the face of it, that was the worst move from one team's perspective that we saw this winter, at least involving significant players. But I'm willing to be a little more patient, maybe, than Dave is.
So I will say, like, when I wrote up my analysis of the trade, I basically said, here's how this is going to work for the Tigers. The Tigers are right about Robbie Ray. No, he's a Texas pitcher. It's whatever the name of the not great pitching prospect the Tigers got was. They're higher on him than everyone else in baseball. If they're right and he's a top 50 pitching prospect, or he's a potential number 3 or number 4 starter, 6 or 7 years of that is worth more than 2 years of Doug Fister. Plus, they got a couple other things in the deal that aren't useless. If they're right about him and he really is a top-notch pitching prospect, then they win. This is a good deal for them. If the other 29 teams and Baseball America and John Sickles and Jason Parks and all these people who don't think this guy is a top 100 pitching prospect and he's maybe more of a number 5 who might end up in the bullpen, then even if Doug Fister never pitches for the Nationals, they could have done better. And I think that's kind of the thing that I look at when I say, you can evaluate the trade best at the time, not necessarily in retrospect, which I know a lot of people go against, and they say you can only evaluate a trade once you know how all the pieces have happened and, you know, whether the guy got run over by a car or whatever, because, you know, if Doug Fister got runs over by a car, that doesn't help the Tigers all that much. But I think that if we look at Doug Fister and say he had some amount of value in the, even if the Tigers knew his elbow was maybe going to hurt in the spring, 29 other teams didn't know that, they could have sold Doug Fister for some kind of package that exceeded the value they got in return, unless they're right about this guy that they got who's awesome that no one else thinks is awesome. I think in talking to other teams who may have wanted to top the Nationals' offer, the Tigers were looking for a very specific thing, and I think Dombrowski even said that in the article Rob wrote. He wanted a young, cost-controlled starting pitcher back, and so he called about Taijuan Walker and Archie Bradley and all these
guys. He made a list of like seven teams he wanted to talk to when there were probably 29 teams that had pitchers better prospects than what he got.
Yeah, I think the question is, should he have narrowed himself down to say, I want a young pitching prospect, when he could have gotten potentially, you know, a third baseman or a catcher or something else that was more valuable and more available? Just because you call about Archie Bradley and Taijuan Walker and everyone tells you to go pound sand doesn't mean you need to settle for the 27th best pitching prospect, because that's the best one you can get. And I think from my perspective, it's not even so much whether Fister's elbow holds up or they shouldn't have traded Doug Fister. They had enough pitching to trade a pitcher. I just think from talking with other teams and looking at the return they got versus even what Matt Garza, who, you know, all kinds of elbow injuries there, or rental player 3 months ago, what the market has dictated for this kind of player, they sold for 60 or 70 cents on the dollar. Even if they knew Fister was going to get hurt, they should have still kept that information to themselves and sold him for 95 cents on the dollar instead.
And, you know, often you'll see a team that has depth at a certain position want to trade the older or more expensive guy when they can plug in a cheaper guy who might be almost as good. So you look at the Tigers, and even if that move wasn't so good, they could plug Drew Smyly into the rotation. And Drew Smiley's a really good pitcher. He could be a successful starter. He wanted to start. So you can understand why they might want to make a move in the rotation, and why maybe they would be a little quicker to pull the trigger on a deal because they have this great plan B ready to go. But even so, you know, you would want the team to get the most for that asset that they can, even if they're not losing all that much between that guy and the next option. You'd still want them to hold out and get the most that they can for that asset because, you know, to another team, he might be a really big upgrade and you could get a big return for that. It's always interesting to talk about what moves you liked and didn't like when you're looking at the people who work for those teams. A little different than when you're writing about it.
Well, that's why it's more fun to talk about the Tigers since they're not here. So along those lines, how do we feel about the Tigers this year? I mean, there's a lot of change in that lineup with Infante gone, with Fister gone, with Kinsler for fielder. I mean, do we think that they're going to be in a full season with Iglesias at short? Do we feel like they're going to be a force still? Or where do you see the Tigers racking up this year, given the Royals getting better?
I think what's fun about the Tigers is that they remade their team, but they're projected to win exactly the same number of games they projected to win last year. I think before last season, they were at 92 or 93 was the projection, and that's exactly what it is now, even though the whole infield defense is completely remade, and they have a bunch of different hitters and at least one different starting pitcher. But on paper, they're exactly as good as they were a year ago, and it's kind of cool how Dombrowski was able to like make them obviously the best team in the division with all these different parts.
Yeah, I just wrote an article for ESPN Insider and Fangraphs Plus like 2 weeks ago that said the headline was, you know, because ESPN likes headlines, was the Tigers were the team to beat in 2014. And if you look at the Fangraphs playoff odds, we have them at like a 13% chance of winning the World Series, higher than any other team in baseball. It doesn't mean we think that they're the best team in baseball. They're kind of in that same range as Washington and St. Louis and Boston and some really good teams. I don't think they're necessarily the best team in baseball. But the gap between them and the rest of the American League Central, all due respect to the Royals, who I also think had a pretty decent offseason, there's like a, you know, we have a projected like 8-win gap between them and the Royals and like a 10-win gap between them and the Indians. No other team in baseball has as much of a cushion as the Tigers did. So even though I didn't really like the Doug Fister deal for them, I loved the Prince Fielder trade for them. I liked some of the other things they did. I still think if you were going to bet on a team to win the World Series right now, the Tigers are your best chance, even though they're very different than they were last year. I think this is kind of like Rob said, a fun example of how, you know, the slugging prowess that they had isn't necessarily what made them good. What made them good was Verlander and Scherzer and Anibal Sanchez and Miguel Cabrera, and all those guys are still there.
Yeah, I'm with these guys. On the last Clubhouse Confidential episode of this season, Brian asked us to make bold predictions, or made us make bold predictions in my case. And I picked the Royals to make the playoffs. A bold prediction. You know, I like what the Royals did. Even so, I think that would have to be a wild card berth, because I do think the Tigers are still the class of that division, and it doesn't seem all that close. I know that BIS just released their projections for team defense, and the Tigers were one of the worst last year, and they're projected to be one of the best this year. And you look at the changes they made, you know, subtracting Fielder and moving Cabrera to first base, and having a little more Iglesias, and maybe Kinsler and Torrey Hunter maybe having a better year. All those things combined to make you think that they'll probably be a bit better at catching the ball, and they still have those starters, and they still have some pretty big bats. So,
How good do those pitchers look now?
Yeah. Right, yeah. That too.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be crazy.
Can someone tweet that a member of Baseball Prospectus just cited Baseball Info Solutions data? That's kind of groundbreaking, right?
Yes. Colin
Wires. No one in here knows what's the... Okay, fine. That would have been funny if you had known the backstory. But. Yeah, the BIS guys think that's funny. Yeah.
What about the free agent moves in the offseason? What was your... what do you like as the best free agent signing, and what do you like? What do you think is the worst free agent signing? Ben,
I like the Phil Hughes deal a lot. I know a lot of people liked it, and I looked at Phil Hughes about 10 days ago, just looking at his pitch selection, because it's just a rite of spring. Every year, Phil Hughes tinkers with his pitch selection, and this year he's throwing a cutter. This year he's not throwing a cutter. He's ditching the slider. He's going to throw more curves. It changes year to year, and you see that he'll start out throwing certain pitches every spring, and then by the middle of the year he's changed things up again. So it's hard to say exactly what he is or what he'll be throwing, but if you just look at his performance away from Yankee Stadium as an extreme fly ball pitcher going to a pretty fly ball friendly park, seems like he could be, you know, possibly a league average pitcher without really improving all that much. And teams pay a lot of money for league average pitchers, and Minnesota didn't pay a whole lot for him. So I like that deal.
Yeah, I'd go with Brian McCann. I think the Yankees getting McCann, even if you just look at what he is as an offensive catcher, he's maybe the third or fourth best hitting catcher in baseball right now. That park is absolutely perfect for a pull-happy left-handed power guy. He draws walks. He makes contact. This is a really good offensive catcher. And then, as Mr. Lindbergh will tell you, he's worth like 147 catching runs a game or something with his framing. If you put any value at all on the framing estimates that are currently out there, even if you're regressing them 50 or 75%, WAR is basically underrating Brian McCann by a win. If you don't regress them all that heavily and you buy into framing, Brian McCann's being underrated by like 3 wins a year, which would make him like, you know, one of the 10 best players in baseball. I think when we look at what $85 million buys you in free agency right now, it's like a fourth outfielder and a relief pitcher. I mean, you know, free agency is very expensive. Brian McCann signing for half of what Jacoby Ellsbury got, or, you know, a third of what Masahiro Tanaka got, to me, doesn't really make a lot of sense, considering how good he is, how good his track record is, the fact that even the nerds who like him are probably still underrating him. I know he's not going to catch forever, but he only needs to be a good catcher for 2 or 3 years. Then he can move to first base and be a good first baseman for a while. I think $585 for Brian McCann, good job to the Yankees for stealing a good free agent.
He's one of the best pitch blockers also.
Right. Yeah. He's good at everything.
Mm-hmm.
I basically forget everything that happened before I touched down in Phoenix the other night.
So you really like the Irvin Santana signing then?
Royals signed Ramon Troncoso.
I will say this. I think I'm stealing a page from your book, aren't I? Chris Capuano was a hell of a deal.
Yeah. I love Chris Capuano.
There aren't the fact teams are so much better, and Ben mentioned this before, where the bad moves, good moves. Teams have gotten very good at valuing players, putting a number on them.
Yeah.
There aren't many dumb deals. We can always look at the ones that are the mega long-term deals, because those always look silly 6 or 7 years in. If you can get a decent major league starting pitcher for less than $8 million, there's a huge value there. So I guess Capuano is one that jumps out at me, probably because he just tweeted about it a few days ago.
Yeah, I do think it's interesting how the Rangers got Joe Saunders for $1 million, right? Like, there's a bunch of these deals like this that are a couple million dollars for a totally serviceable back end arm. And then we see these teams that are like trying to win, and it's like, Randy Wolf's our number 3 starter coming out of camp. And it's like, what's the deal? I don't quite understand, to Rob's point, why some of these teams are not willing to kick in a few million dollars for a guy who's totally okay, and then they're like, oh yeah, we're going to contend this year, and you've never heard of our number two starter.
Yeah, there's so much value in not having to call up three guys from AAA that struggle and get hurt or whatever.
Yeah,
isn't part of it too the sense of trying to anticipate where the market's going? And once you play your card, there's a reluctance to then go back and pick up Saunders and figure out what you're going to do with the piece you've already signed because you've already signed it. So I think there's a mindset that teams are willing to wait and take the best of what's left, which may not be the player that they wanted, but it'll probably be a better value, or they set their sights on a specific player, make the move early, and take the risk as to whether the market goes this way or goes that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think if you sign a free agent early, you're basically paying for the right to pick the guy you want, and you pay some kind of premium for that. But it seems like, Zimmerman, and we've seen a bunch of injury stuff. We know that teams aren't going to go into the season with five starters. So anyone who... the Red Sox basically signed Chris Capuano as you'll relieve unless someone dies and then you might start. Every team should be doing that. They should have three guys in the bullpen who are, you can be a good lefty reliever and then we can stretch you out if we need you. I think that's the thing with Saunders and Capuano and these guys. They'll have value in October as left-on-left relievers unless they're needed as a starter. And so I think when you see Boone Logan getting $15 million a year that would be a real overpay. That would be the worst deal of the year.
Yes.
Boone Logan at $15 million a year. $15 million in total from the Rockies. When a guy like Capuano or Saunders or Paul Mahomes or whoever, some starter you put in the bullpen, can be just as good and can also start if you need him to, or is getting $1 million, it seems like there's a bit of an imbalance there where you can get one of these left-handed starters with big platoon splits who can give you 150 okay innings for pretty cheap.
Sam Miller wrote a piece this morning for BP on rotation depth and looking at who had the best sixth and seventh starters, and he was raving about how the A's had such great rotation depth and, their sixth and seventh starters project to be better than the Angels' third starter. And since then, I guess two A's starters are going to see James Andrews. So yeah, that can evaporate very quickly.
Who was the first team? There was a team 4 or 5 years ago. One team started sort of this trend of literally starting the season with six viable starting pitchers. Maybe it was the Red Sox. Mm-hmm. And I thought a lot more teams would do it, and it really hasn't happened. I guess there aren't that many to go around.
Well, I think also probably these veteran guys generally want a rotation spot.
Right. Yeah.
Not a lot of them are willing to be Chris Capuano type swing guys.
Right.
But I do think, maybe you can have your young guy who doesn't really have a say in the matter start the year in that swing guy role, and you give a Chris Capuano or a Paul Mahomes or whatever the fifth starter job, and then you tell, your young flame-throwing guy, you're not going to call him up till June, because then you've saved service time, you've, made sure he's not going to blow out his arm.
Well, we've been having this argument for years. I mean, ever since I started writing, wondering why more teams didn't take young pitchers and start them in the bullpen,
right,
young starters, and they still don't do it. And maybe there's somebody who could tell me that they're more likely to get hurt if they're not pitching every fifth day, five or six innings. But I still, I always thought it'd be a great way to work them in terms of just getting used to the major league. But it'd also be nice to just have them around in case you need them to start.
Right.
Every now and then you see a manager get really attached to the idea of that pitcher never starting, though,
yeah,
which is always a risk because
That's right.
Put a guy who could start into the eighth or ninth inning.
Right.
He's unhittable. Managers like guys who are unhittable in the eighth or ninth inning, so that's one
problem.
Plus,
the pitcher repertoire is completely different, right? So, I remember when Sale and Price came into the league and finished out their first seasons as in the bullpen, but then they were converted. And if you put a guy in the bullpen, aren't you stunting his growth because you're limiting him pretty much to two pitches versus his full repertoire?
Well, I mean, maybe, but I've read a lot of stories about pitchers learning how to throw new pitches while doing their bullpen work. Mm. I mean, you're going to throw more pitches there than you are in a relief outing anyway. And you can't really be experimenting as a starter, right? I mean, not if you're trying to win games.
I think it matters, too, what we're defining as a reliever. So, to Ben's point, you don't necessarily want to take Archie Bradley and make him the setup guy and turn him into an eighth-inning wonder horse or something. But you could maybe do what...
Did you say wonder horse?
Yeah. I'm making up words up here. It's
oh,
awesome.
Cool. I can write that down.
Tweet out wonder horse. Save our analytics. But I think if you look at what the Twins did with Johan Santana when I think he was a Rule 5 guy, and they basically carried him as a long reliever, a middle guy, I don't know that there's necessarily a pitch repertoire problem. If you're telling this guy, you're going to pitch every 3 or 4 days when one of our starters doesn't do very well, or he's sick, or we're pitching in Colorado and it's 17 to 16 or something, and you're going to bring this guy in for 3 or 4 innings, he's going to have a kind of a mini starter workload. He's not just going to face his own platoon split type guys. And you can kind of develop him as like the tandem starter model they use in the minors. I think having a long guy who's going to pitch low leverage innings, it's not a terrible place to break a rookie.
I just don't want to burn my service time with him in the bullpen. I'd rather have him work. I mean, obviously the situation, these are all situational specific, but in general, I'd rather have this guy in the minors, this young prospect pitcher, building his repertoire, starting every fifth day, than having him burn service time in the bullpen as in an apprentice role.
After June, it doesn't matter, right? Like from June till the end of September, service times are
relevant. Right,
so
right.
It's for the back half of the year.
For the back half of the year is a different story, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the Braves and what they've done recently with their signings and their locking up of their young players. I mean, they really doubled down on a number of talented young players. Just want to get a sense of from you, Ben, whether you think they've sort of too much too soon, or if this is exactly what teams should be doing. What's your take?
I wondered why they hadn't done it sooner, and some people had also, I think, because they, you know, they're one of these teams that's locked into one of the worst, if not the worst, TV contracts, and so it's hard for them to keep up with the spending of the other teams, and so there's the idea that they have to win in a small market way, and so we've seen, you know, teams like the Rays or like the Indians used to lock up all of their young players once they come up, once they establish themselves, or even before they've established themselves. And the Braves seemed like, you know, a team that were primed for that same sort of thing because they have one of the youngest teams and yet also one of the most productive teams, which is kind of a rare combination. And yet those guys were not under team control for very long because they had come up so young and they'd been around for a bit already. So it seemed like a perfect situation to lock up a bunch of guys. I talked to John Hart, who is a senior advisor for them, and of course almost pioneered the extension trend when he was with Cleveland. And from talking to him, it seemed like something that had been in the works for a while, but their new stadium situation gave them the freedom and the payroll room to make that happen. And he pointed out that once you get one deal done with a guy, then you can sell the next guy. On his extension, you say, we're keeping this whole core together. You guys came up together and you broke in together and we're going to keep you around through your whole primes and we'll definitely have a competitive team because we're going to have all these productive players. And then you get that stability and you can say, okay, we have this much of your payroll is assigned to these guys. We're going to get this much out of these guys. And then you have more flexibility to kind of fill in the rest of your roster around them. So I thought that was great. I was surprised that they were able to get so much done in such a short span of time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is a fact. I mean, I loved it because it provided a ton of content for me. And as an economics nerd, this is like right up my alley. And I really like this part of the game. So for me, it's not even so much the question of whether the Braves did the right thing. I think the Braves did the right thing for their organization, for where they are with their TV contracts. For me, the fascinating part is going to be how the Players Association responds to this trend. Because I do think this is going to be a trend, and teams and players are both going to be interested in moving the window of when long-term deals get signed up. What we have is, you know, major league teams spend about $3.5 billion a year in free on major league players in total. On all spending is about $3.5 billion. Traditionally, what we've seen is that the veterans have made up a large chunk of that pie, and young players with little experience, especially the 0 to 3 guys who haven't qualified for arbitration, get $500,000, $550,000. They get very small chunks of this $3.5 billion. And the savings there by the Angels not paying Mike Trout anything has gone to finance the overpaid albatrosses of Verdon Wells and Albert Pujols and Josh Hamilton. So what we've had is this very disparate situation where mediocre, overpaid, declining players are getting really wealthy, and fantastic young players, homegrown guys through the farm system are getting peanuts, relatively. I'll take 500,000 peanuts if anyone wants to give them to me. But I think it's an interesting trend in that teams should be incentivized to move some of this money that's been going to guys in their 30s on the downside of their career into the guys in their 20s and their primes. And that's exactly what the Braves did. The Braves said, we will give you money now in order to get you through age 29 or age 30 or age 31 because we don't want to pay for 32, 33, 34, 35. If we wait a few years, wait till you're a year away from free agency or 2 years away from free agency and have to give you a 7-year deal then. So by moving the window up, they're essentially moving where they're paying the players from the 30s into the 20s. I think this is great for the teams, and they'll have fewer albatross contracts, and you'll probably have more albatross contracts, but they'll be smaller. So instead of having Josh Hamilton overpaid by $124 million, you'll have Andrelton Simmons overpaid by $5 million if he never learns how to hit. So you'll have kind of not to get too political, but a more equal distribution of wealth within Major League Baseball. I don't know that the Players Association is actually going to go for this, though, because the veterans generally hold most of the power, and they might be like, hey, look, free agency is going to take a hit, and we're going to get less money when we're, in free agency and get that big bite at the apple because teams have already spent their money on extensions. So I think, to me, it's not so much the team's reaction to this, it's how the players are going to respond to this trend that is really fascinating.
Just to tack on that, to that, this is more, it's about economics, it's also about, in politics, it's also about human behavior to some degree. I think that we might be seeing more players want to do this. And by the way, it isn't just these guys who are taking below market contracts. It's Dustin Pedroia, and it's Glenn Perkins today. Apparently it was a below market contract that he... And those guys have said the same thing, basically, which is, how much money do I need to live on? Right. I mean, two or three years ago, I was on a panel like this, I think, might have been this one, and there was a suggestion that with the money becoming so huge, the young players wouldn't take these below-market deals anymore because they wanted to get the big payday. They wanted to wait and get the big payday. But how big a payday do you need? And I think some of them have realized, you know what? If I'm guaranteed $35 million, that's probably enough. There will always be some guys, and I don't know if it's what percentage, that's what the experiment is. What's interesting about it, I don't know what the percentage is of guys who are going to say, I want to make the most money that a person can possibly make, so I'm not going to do this deal. I think there are more guys who are going to say, yeah, that's enough, and I love the security, I love where I am, and the money's so big that it might be seeing a culture change away from money, oddly enough. And when you hear, it isn't just... When you hear the things that Pedroia says, I believe that people mean what they say most of the time. So when Pedroia says, I don't need Robinson Cano money, $50 million or whatever he's guaranteed, that's enough. And when Perkins says what he said, that's enough. I believe them. And I think there might be more players saying that this is enough. I just want to be happy and stay here and play with these guys. And so oddly enough, it's possible that the more money comes into the game, the easier it will be for the have-nots to keep their good young players, not the harder, at least in the short term.
But I think the interesting question is, when does the Players Association begin to intervene with these players and say...
Well, they can't stop them.
No, but they can appeal to their sense. And so I've talked with a few players about this, and one of the things that they feel a sense of... They feel a sense of responsibility to the players who have worked so hard to make the MLBPA very strong and get a very large share of the pie... to where if they just start all taking below market deals and they let the owners get 60, 65, 70% of the revenues and their share of the total league revenues goes down to something that is lower than it's ever been before, they feel like they're giving up what the people who came before them fought for. And there is a sense of responsibility to live up to what the Players Association has already earned. And if they start taking these deals and they're just letting the teams continually grow their revenues without getting the same share, if you're a star-level player and you only get $15 million a year, you're not helping the players coming after you. And I think the players do feel a sense of responsibility, and I think that's one of the things, the sticks the Players Association will be able to carry and say, $35 million might be enough for you to live comfortably. This isn't about you making as much money as possible. It's about you helping in the cause of the players get our fair share and not let the owners take advantage of us.
The bigger the dollars get, the harder it is to make the cause argument, though.
But Dave, your definition of a below market deal is you're equating it to free agent dollars. Well, free agent rates.
So I don't think any of the Braves deals were below market. They were all like record setting, right? I don't think those were below
market.
No,
but when
deals.
You complain about below market deals and that what you worry about the below market deals, you're looking at that as benchmarked against someone who's got 6 years of service time and has in the open market pricing. I mean, why wouldn't the market rate for a 2+ service time player be 80% or 70% of the free agent rate? for performance?
No, I think it absolutely is. I don't remember saying that. Let's use the Andrew McCutchen example, right? So here's a guy who is 24 years old, coming off a 6.5 win season, clearly one of baseball's best young stars, signed for $50 million over 6 years. He sold off 3 free agent years, including the team option, for a total of like $13 million a year. If he had waited 1 year, had his MVP, that number goes to $150, $175, maybe $200 million, just by waiting one more year, mm-hmm. right? So these guys are now taking deals. It's not so much that we're saying you should take on the risk of getting to free agency and maybe blowing out your arm. I think the argument the Players Association can make for these guys is if you're a superstar young player, bet on yourself. Because if you're a 4-win, 5-win player at 24, 25 years old, you're probably going to be really awesome at 27. Go to arbitration once. Set some kind of record that can then be used as a template for the players who come behind you. Get a $15 million award. Get something that sets a benchmark. Get your $150 million. Don't settle for $50 million and leave $100 million on the table like Evan Longoria did.
I do wonder whether we'll see the pendulum swing in the other direction if the free agent pool shrinks to such an extent that there are only a few attractive players available in any given offseason, then the incentives maybe change a little bit in favor of not signing that extension, because as Dave said, some teams will spend all their money on extensions and not have it to spend on free agents, but there are always teams that won't develop their own young players. There's always the Yankees, basically. And so if you're that team and you have a lot of money to spend, you can't spend it on your own players, you can't spend it in the draft, you can't really spend it on the international market, you're going to spend it on whoever is available in that offseason. And if that means, you know, if there are just a few guys you want in that offseason, those guys are really going to cash in. So you see that happen for a few years, maybe you'll see players start to think twice about committing to that extension instead of waiting, you know, once the risk and reward sort of balances out a bit.
I'd like to go to one other question before we go to the questions from the audience. Dave, I know, if I'm not mistaken, you've been outspoken about many things, actually, true. I'll just pick one of many. The qualifying offer system that we have today. Talk a little bit about your perspective on it.
Yeah, I think like we have some skewed incentives right now, and I think Jared Saltalamacchi actually talked to John Heyman about this today and said he knew he wasn't going to get $14 million a year in free agency, and he still turned down the qualifying offer, or he would have if he had received it in his mind, because he didn't care about the annual average value. He wanted years. And in talking to some of these players and talking to agents, this seems to be the trend in recent years. They don't care about maximizing salary anymore, and I think that's one of the reasons why we've seen salary stagnated around $25 million a year, and that's been the top salary for a while now, is because players want the longest deal possible. They want, you know, Joey Votto's 12-year deal, or they want Robinson Cano's 10-year deal, or even Jason Vargas's 4-year deal from, you know, an average major league starter. I think these guys really want to be able to know where they're going to spring training every year. They want to be able to buy a house. They want to maybe be able to buy a house in the state they have spring training. They want to be able to tell their family, like, this is where we're going to be for a while. They care about years, and the qualifying offer is a 1-year offer that is not enticing to them, even at a high annual average value. Like Kendrys Morales is not worth $14 million a year. Nelson Cruz is not worth $14 million a year. So it's easy to tell these guys, well, you made your own bed because you turned down $14 million. That's a lot of money. You weren't worth that. You should have taken it. But they don't care about the annual average value as much as they would care about the years. For a lot of these guys, they'll take $320 over $114, even though that's basically adding on two years at $3 million a year. It's not a good deal from an annual average value standpoint, but they really want the years. They want the security. So I think MLB has to at least look at a system that aligns the incentives of the players to where if what the player is reaching free agency for is a chance to get a long-term deal, he at least has the chance to turn down a long-term deal. And I think there's a pretty good argument to be made that the entire qualifying offer system, the entire point of it is a tax to hold down free agent salaries on players. So why are we only taxing guys like Ubaldo Jimenez and players who kind of fall in that bubble where, you know, no one really cares about paying a $5 million or $10 million tax on Robinson Cano? You're already paying $240 million. That $10 million doesn't matter. If you're paying a $5 or $10 million tax on a guy for $30 million, that's now a huge percentage of the cost of the contract. Why are we taxing just this bubble player who's, you know, worth somewhere in the $10 to $12 million a year range and not taxing the entire spread of free agents? Maybe if we just say, what kind of tax do we agree that we want to apply on free agents, let's just spread it across all the free agents instead of on like six.
Ben, where are you on this issue?
Pretty much the same place. I mean, I don't expect to see it change under the current CBA, it sounds like, but I would be surprised if it didn't change in some fashion for the next one. And You know, we used to complain about the old Elias type A, type B system, too.
And that one was more terrible.
No one was happy with that. This is probably better than that. I don't think this is something that anyone is really thrilled with. I mean, if you just look at the teams that it tends to benefit, I mean, ostensibly it's supposed to be a measure that increases competitive balance, whereas the teams that tend to benefit from the qualifying offer are not the ones that need help, really. So if you look at it, it's just a collectively bargained thing that the owners have won the right to have and save some money, then, you know, it makes sense that it exists, I suppose, but it's not really a very rational, very smart system, I don't think. It's problematic to couple free agents to draft pick compensation, I think, and I wouldn't be surprised if that went away.
Rob?
Oh, it's going to go away. I mean, it there's nobody involved can believe that it's a good system when Stephen Drew isn't playing on March 14th. And I think that it will be addressed. I don't know how. They'll figure something out.
Why don't we move to the audience for questions? Whoever gets the mic.
Okay. Hello.
Would you please stand up?
Yep. Hi. You mentioned earlier how Brian McCann offered a little bit of surplus value based off his pitch framing. I was wondering, in terms of quantifying the value of catcher defense, how does each of the elements of catcher defense stack up? What percentage of that is blocking, framing, controlling the running game, that kind of stuff?
I think what we've found from all the studies that have been published recently is that framing really seems to be the single biggest thing. And I know historically people have tended to judge catcher defense on their arm and, you know, how good they are at throwing out base runners. And if you saw Ben's presentation just a little bit, we keep finding out more and more that it's the pitcher who has more to do with runners getting thrown out than the catcher. And if you look at all the framing studies, you know, it's really a range of 4 or 5 wins between the good guys and the bad guys. And nothing else really compares to that in terms of stopping the running game or blocking or fielding batted balls or anything. That really does seem to be the biggest thing, even after you regress it and you adjust for the umpire and the pitcher and the count and all of these different factors that can influence whether a pitch is called a strike or not. That consistently just keeps coming up as the most impactful thing, and it seems to be pretty consistent from year to year.
Yeah, I would say, like, in the estimates of framing that are publicly on Ben's side and on Stat Corner, and, you know, Jeff Sullivan's done a bunch of work on this, everyone who's done estimates on pitch framing has apparently determined that this is the most important skill any player can have, period. It's more important than hitting home runs or anything. I mean, it's like a plus 30 span on the positive side down to, like, negative 700 for Ryan Dumit, who should never be allowed to catch again. And I think, I mean, you know, I love the research that's been done. I think it's a fascinating topic. I am somewhat inclined to disbelieve the range. I think that the span that we see of the pitch framing numbers is probably overestimating the catcher's impact on the framing. I think this is a conversation that I've had with a few people here this weekend, including Rob. I think if, like, you know, an example would be if David Price throws a pitch outside the strike zone because he knows Jose Molina is very good at getting the umpire to call the pitch in correctly. If you're doing an accounting system, and you say, I'm going to give the catcher full 100% credit for turning that what was a ball into a strike because Jose Molina did a really good job of receiving it and tricked the umpire, we're also at the same time telling David Price that he did a bad thing by throwing a pitch out of the strike zone, right? So if you're going to give full credit to Jose Molina for turning a ball into a strike, you're penalizing David Price and telling him, you threw a ball. That was bad. Bad job, David Price. But David Price threw that pitch to Jose Molina. He knew what he was doing. He knew what he was throwing to. So I think that we have to remember that the pitcher's involved in framing pitches too. And I think there probably are guys, my guess would be if we had framing data for like the 1990s, Tom Glavine probably would have been consistently framed very well because we knew his strike zone was like 7 feet wide. It probably wasn't all Charlie O'Brien, right? I think there's guys like that who are probably pretty good at this and help their catcher get strikes. And so I would say that, you know, maybe you give some credit to the pitcher, some credit to the catcher. That brings down the value of framing because now you're giving some credit to the pitcher. It's not that I don't think framing is important. I certainly think it is. I think the spread that we've seen published publicly is maybe a little too large.
Yeah, next question.
Can I switch them real quick?
Sure.
Dave and I had this conversation yesterday. I asked him, okay, if Jose Molina is so great, as you know, if he's as great as the numbers say, why didn't he get more money? Because there are a lot of teams out there that are smart enough to pay attention to the data. What did he get? What was his contract?
2-4. Mm-hmm.
$2 million a year, and if you go by the pitch frame, he's worth
$400 million a year.
$15 or $20 million a year, and you got nothing close to that. So it does make you go back and, you know, look at the facts and question what you thought was true.
Yeah, I think in Molina's case, it has a lot to do with, I mean, if you look at his career trajectory, it's really, there's almost no comparison for a guy having as much time in the majors as a backup and then becoming a starter at an advanced age. You know, in his late 30s, he's starting for the first time. I think it's really hard not to see that as somehow related to all these studies. And I think the fact that he is not a very good hitter, a terrible blocker, apparently, you know, not in the best conditioning, I could say, generously.
You
can't really count on him to have a starter's
in a lightning bolt of speed.
Right, too. Exactly. So I think if you factor in all of those things, maybe you can understand why that is. But I should say, you know, the latest framing study that was published at BP, you know, did try to account for the pitcher and looked at pitchers who tended to get the most extra strikes and the fewest extra strikes, and Glavine was at the top of that leaderboard, and it, you know, there was some number of runs that we calculated that that you should take away from his catchers when you're calculating their framing impact because they were catching Tom Glavine. So there's still some work to be done there and things to account for, but we've made some attempts.
With microphone? Yeah.
So we saw a couple guys like Yasiel Puig, Gerrit Cole, and Michael Wacha make huge impacts on their team's postseason run and in the playoffs. Could you guys just quickly talk about a few guys maybe this year who might come up and make similar impacts?
Isn't there a prospects panel tomorrow? I defer to Jim Callis.
Well, if we could count guys who already made some sort of appearance in the majors, I mean, I think, you know, Yordano Ventura with the Royals, who we just saw make a few outings last year. Whether they use him in the rotation is, you know, it seems like he could handle or stick him in the bullpen with their 10 other really good relievers. He's someone who seems like he could make an impact right away, be one of those, you know, guys we saw last year who just comes out of the gate and is effective right away. Or, you know, someone like Danny Salazar with Cleveland, who we saw for about 50 innings last year. Over a full season, he could be a top sort of starter. So a lot of the playoff teams last year did have guys like that who just kind of, you know, made an impact right away. And we have seen, you know, there's been some work by Jeff, I guess, at your site about how aging curves have seemed to change and how teams have, you know, promoted guys when they're ready to contribute. So we don't see the usual historical curve that goes like that. It's just guys get there and they're this productive and then eventually they decline. So we are seeing more and more of that.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah, I just was wondering if you could offer your opinions on the incentives under the new systems for international amateur free agents or just sort of international free agents in general.
Well, I think one thing we've heard, you know, we'll see if it happens come July, but I think Kylie McDaniel and others have reported that the Yankees are prepared to just blow the system out of the water, and they're going to spend like $20 million and just take whatever fine MLB wants to throw at them. And I'm really looking forward to this. I think this is fantastic. I love when teams like expose these silly little limits that the MLB should have never imposed and be like, this system is dumb. And it sounds like that's what the Yankees are going to do, and I think it's going to be hilarious to watch as they sign every player or every person born in a Latin American country to some 10-year contract, and then just be like...
Wait, I'm not following the logic. Why would you not want to have any limits at all? Just because they expose the absurdity of it.
So I'm not in favor of no limits. I just think this current system is poorly designed.
Got it.
And I look forward to the Yankees blowing the system up. I think it's kind of
right.
A fun
thing. The system needs to be blown up.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah. And this is the best way to do it.
Go Yankees.
Yep.
Spend all the money.
Do you have a microphone, Craig?
You talked about how when players reach a certain age and they're eligible for free agency, money may not be there because we see Pujols getting this large contract and Hamilton hasn't panned out. I did made a model with a colleague of mine showing that even at an age where the player has maxed out on his productivity on the field, there was a certain marquee value that generated revenues for the team. So the actual signing of a player, so the Angels signing Hamilton or Pujols, they could raise ticket prices, they could generate revenue. Forget about wins and losses. And I wanted to direct this, because I know Vince Gennaro wrote a book on this, to Vince and anyone, Mike, Dave Cameron, whom, your thoughts that this will still continue, because maybe that's why Seattle signed Cano, because the fact that they made this splash sign, even if he goes downhill, they can raise their ticket prices. They may be able to negotiate a local television contract that's more lucrative. I wanted to get your response that if that this trend you think will continue for that reason.
You know, I would suggest that some of those factors are present. I don't think they remotely justify, you know, the last $105,000 of the 240, but you know, $105 million of the 240. But yeah, I think there's a factor there, and I think there is an element of credibility. I mean, with TV contracts, there's a level of expectation that sort of goes hand in hand with that, and I think it sends a huge signal to the fan base. What that's worth, you know, you may have more confidence in the numbers than I do, but I don't think it's even remotely on a scale that justifies the kind of risk associated with the deal. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm underestimating the power of all this, and that this is a inflection point in the franchise's history, and it will be forever thought of in a different universe. But it just seems like it's disproportionate. It's real, but disproportionate.
Yeah, I think I tried to study this a couple years ago, and it's changing a little bit because attendance isn't how teams make all their money now. But to your point, like Albert Pujols was the marquee free agent signing of the last, I don't know, 20 or 30 years or something. This is an inner circle Hall of Famer hitting the market, still looking like one of the best players in baseball. The Angels signed him and C.J. Wilson, and they were adding Mike Trout, who's like the best young player anyone's ever seen, and their attendance went down. It went down. Like, I think, to me, if there was something to this marquee player drawing fans to the park, that would have been a fantastic place to see it, and we didn't see it. And I've looked at some other things. I think maybe the best example I could find of a marquee guy selling tickets was when Ken Griffey Jr. got traded back to Seattle, or to Cincinnati. This is where his dad played, Hall of Fame career, beloved son, from the area. They got a one-year spike. Attendance went up $500,000. But, or 500,000 fans, the team was terrible and they all went away. And their attendance was actually lower in year two than it was the year before they acquired Griffey. So I think there's probably some year one spike if you get an exact right fit, but it doesn't last.
Or multiple players. Like the Blue Jays' ticket sales went way up last spring.
Yeah, they went way down this year.
Right.
Yeah.
They grabbed a bunch of guys in year one. You know, I've looked at attendance not as well as he has over the, but there are three obvious ways to spike attendance. One is to get a new ballpark. Two is to win. Three is to make a big splash, whether on the free agent market or on the trade market. Those things can all work, but two of them, the new ballpark and the big splash in the offseason, are short term. And they go away. So a 10-year contract for a huge amount of money, you're going to get that. The Mariners, I'm sure, are selling more tickets this spring than they did last spring. But if they don't win, those go away. The other thing that you brought up, which is really interesting, is the percentage of revenue that now comes from ticket sales as opposed to the TV deals. So much of the money that comes in now is local TV money, and it's almost accidental how much you get. Yeah. Because if you just happen to have had a great season or won a World Series, when your new deal is coming online, you make a huge... But if you're coming off a couple of losing seasons, how much difference does that make? I don't know. I've never seen a model, but I guess it's... And then that determines your payroll for the next 10 or 20 years.
Yeah.
But that's why teams are consciously planning their window or doubling down based on the timing of these long-term deals and anticipation of it. So I think there's a it's not just a matter of luck of hitting it right. It's literally where the money's flowing.
To some degree, yeah. But I think that the way the money comes in is so radically different than it's ever been before.
Yeah.
I think it has to be addressed in the coming years in the CBAs and just the revenue sharing, all that stuff, because it's a new world, and they haven't changed it. The system hasn't changed internally, but externally, the way the money flows in, it's completely different than it used to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So part of the conference was a case competition, and each of the teams had to pick their three most valuable pitchers, and contracts mattered. Maybe you guys want to comment on who you have as the three most valuable pitchers.
Three with the highest surplus value.
Right. So I think in this case competition, it was almost a trick, right? Like, if you don't pick Jose Fernandez, you fail. Was that how it was? Like,
no.
Automatic,
no.
You're out?
No.
It should have been. If you don't pick Jose Fernandez, you fail, I think.
There were nine of the 20 teams did not have Fernandez first. 11 of the 20 did.
Well, he has to be in the top three.
He doesn't have to be one, but he has
to be in the top three. I think Fernandez, Sale, and Bumgarner are the names I heard the most from the guys who went through it, and I have a hard time arguing with any of those three. Maybe if you really don't believe in Chris Sale's long-term health, you could swap in a Yu Darvish or, I heard talk to some guys who had Matt Harvey even after his rehab. If you like the Tommy John recovery process and you think Matt Harvey is that special, I'm okay with, any number of pitchers. But I think Jose Fernandez has to be in there, and then pick two of awesome guys.
I miss the competition, but it seems to me that the clear winner would be anyone who could come up with the perfect way to estimate injury risk, which major league teams haven't been able to figure out yet. So, but those are the three guys.
It is interesting, though, that that the general, and certainly up here even the consensus, but also with the 20 teams, was to put an enormously high value on Fernandez, despite the, and I know he was absolutely dazzling, but the track record is not as extensive as a lot of other pitchers that Madison Bumgarner, for example, is much more extensive track record. So at the major league level, so it's just interesting that I feel like we sort of looked past the fact of his short tenure.
Yeah, I feel like with pitchers, I need less of a track record to be confident. Once you watch Jose Fernandez and see what he throws, and see how he gets better as the season goes on, I don't know whether he can continue to throw like that indefinitely. But for now, I have as much confidence in him as anyone.
Sure. Next.
Hello, I'm from Korea, and I have a question over. Posting system. Recently, Japanese baseball organization and then Major League Baseball organization made an agreement to limit the posting fee. It gives an equal opportunities for all major league teams to participate in the posting system. But eventually, small market team cannot acquire good international players. So, what do you think of this revised posting system between Japanese baseball organization and Major League Baseball organization?
Yeah, I think it seemed to me that in the process of coming up with this new system, Major League Baseball was incentivized to give less money to the Japanese teams and more money to the players, which is an understandable. I mean, if you're Yu Darvish and you cost $100 million and you're only getting $50 million of that, that's probably frustrating. Like, Yu Darvish is dramatically underpaid right now. So I can see why the Texas Rangers would have preferred to give more money to the guy who's on their team and in their clubhouse and, cashing their checks than some team that they're never going to have to deal with again. It does seem like the arbitrary $20 million cap is maybe not the best way of doing it. And I think Ben Badler of Baseball America has written about how there's plenty of opportunity for corruption here where, some team can be like, well, we're only going to bid $20 million on this guy, and then we're also going to bid $20 million on his cousin who has never played baseball. What do you know? That's an amazing coincidence. We just happen to like his cousin more than everyone else. So I do think the system has some potential abuses, but the main point of it seemed to be taking money from the Japanese team and giving it to the player, which seems like not a terrible idea to me.
I'm not a huge fan of the system because I think it just closes the small and mid-market teams out of the elite international player market, and they're already closed out of the elite domestic player free agent market from a pricing standpoint, and this just transfers those similar economics with the $20 million tax to the Japanese system, to the Japanese players. I'd rather see a system whereby, by paying a certain fee, someone gets perhaps, I don't know, I'm just throwing this out, teams get entered into a lottery of which, five teams are picked, and those five teams have the exclusive negotiating rights or the communal negotiating rights with the player. Something that would allow teams like the Pittsburgh Pirates to perhaps get a Japanese free agent someday that's of a Tanaka level.
I just wanted to ask you guys a little bit about the new defensive player tracking system we were introduced to this offseason. First of all, I mean, it kind of seems like a pretty cool tool that we have access to at this point, but what do you guys think the value that it has in terms of evaluating future free agents and even the value that players have in trade situations?
What system? I'm sorry?
The defensive player tracking system.
Well, we'll see if we have access to it. That's still very much up in the air for us, at least. I mean, of course, it's really interesting, really compelling. I think, you know, I wrote about it a bit after the Sloan conference and the presentation, and I mean, it's just, you know, being able to judge players based on their innate skills and the process by which they do things rather than the results of how they do things. So, you know, being able to go in and look at a guy, whereas in the past, you know, we'll say, well, you need 3 seasons worth of defensive metrics to tell whether this guy is any good. And you might say, well, a scout can go in there and he can tell you right away if this guy is any good. You know, can he run fast? Does he take a good route? All of these things that don't show up in the stats for a while because you only get X number of opportunities per year and you might not get as many this year and you don't differentiate yourself as much according to that system. But this thing will tell you, you know, right away, is he fast, which is not something that a slow player can fake, really. You know, it's almost like fastball velocity. A pitcher who throws hard most of the time. Not necessarily always, but a pitcher who doesn't throw hard is not going to luck into throwing 100 miles per hour all, you know, once in a while. So I think, you know, it has the potential to make everything much more precise, much more revolutionary. It's something I've wondered about for a while, you know, how much access we will have as opposed to the teams. How much are we going to get to play with? Are we just going to see the high-level stuff, the output, like we saw in the Jason Hayward video where, you know, they tell us he ran this fast and had this route efficiency and we just look that up somewhere else? Or are we going to get access to the raw data and be able to do all the fun things that we've done with PitchFX over the years? So all of that still remains to be decided, but clearly there's a lot of potential there.
You know, one of the encouraging aspects of it, and again, I don't know where the data will find itself in the public domain or not, but one of the more interesting things for me is that with these measures, once they become broad scale, defense should improve. And to me, there is nothing that happens on a baseball field that's more interesting and exciting than great defense. I could watch defensive plays on a loop reel for 15 hours and never see a player come to bat, and I wouldn't mind it. It's just my personal bias, but I think it'll be great for the game because I think it will focus more on defense. We'll know that we're making improvements to defense, and you'll see the level of defense in the league ratchet up even further.
Vince, you're right. Defense is going to get better and better, but it's going to become less and less important.
Yeah.
Because of all the strikeouts.
Well, you're right. There's, with the 3-2 outcome.
Sorry, it's a hobby horse
of
mine.
That's a fair point. Let's take one last question.
I hate strikeouts, by the way, while he's moving.
We didn't notice. You should write about this more often.
Strikeouts are the worst.
So now that we've had a little bit of opportunity to see the new replay system in effect in spring training games, has that changed your opinion in any way about what it is, and what is your opinion in general on this expanded instant replay?
Well, I think we're going to want to see how much time it adds to the games. I think everybody up here wants to see more calls made correctly. And this is going to do that, and we're not going to go back. We're not going backwards. We're only going to add more. There are calls now they're not going to use it for. I can't believe that they say they're not going to use it for the neighborhood play. How long can that last? How can you just take one play and say, we're going to continue to do that one wrong? I know they say it's a safety issue. I don't buy it.
Well, I think what they should have done is legislated the neighborhood play legal. So basically, you're required to be in contact with the base and the ball to get a force out, except in an instance where you feel that it could lead to injury, which gives the umpire the total latitude, make it a non-challengeable play, and basically legalize the neighborhood play.
That would be fantastic. You're like first baseman running away from the base. I was scared for my life. No. I couldn't go near the base. I'm totally in favor of that. That'd be fun.
You know what? If you can't make the play without getting hurt, you don't get to make the play. Right? It seems like a basic principle.
No. So the runner should get a knife? He can run down the...
I, I love the instant replay. I love the concept. I loved it from the beginning. I wanted to see it for years. I think it should be extended. I think the manager's challenge will become an exciting play in the game. I'm sure most everybody up here disagrees with that, but I really am looking forward to it, and I think it'll add to the game. I think any additional time it creates will be consumed with a lot more interest than what goes on typically between pitches anyway. So I'm a big proponent of it and wouldn't be surprised if it got extended and expanded even further as time goes on over the next years.
What I'd like to see is take it away from the managers and crowdsource it. So everyone in the stadium gets a little button. And if you want to challenge, you have to convince everyone in your section that that's a good play to challenge. So there's one crowdsourced challenge per game. Game theory in attendance would be fantastic.
Right. I mean, the thing with the challenge system is that as the incentives are aligned currently, it makes sense to challenge just about anything that looks conceivably like a close call. And I know, you know, Zachary Levine wrote a thing for BP earlier this week looking at how the challenges have been used so far in spring training, and the time that it's taken to review the plays has not really been that bad, but so few of the challenges have been upheld just because there are so many challenges and not really all that many terrible calls in a typical game. So I think we're going to see managers using those challenges early and often, and when it's a case that it's not really that close a call, but it made sense, you know, probabilistically, statistically, to challenge anyway, then we're probably going to get sick of those 2-3 minute delays. So I do wonder whether there will be fewer challenges or possibly some sort of penalty for challenging and then not having your challenge upheld.
What would you want the penalty to be? Like, you have to bring in your worst pitcher?
Zach proposed, you know, like either a ball or a strike penalty sort of thing, or maybe losing a guy on your bench, something like that.
I like that a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Vote off a player. That'd be great.
Yeah.
Yadier Molina, you're out of the game because Mike Matheny made a bad challenge. That'd be fun.
Vince, can I finish with another quote since we have the audience?
Well, I was going to suggest that.
I thought you might be. I'm so impatient. It's a quote from the great British scientist Lord Kelvin, as Marconi was doing his experiments with the wireless telegraphy, as they called it then. Kelvin said, "Wireless is all very well, but I'd rather send a message by a boy on a pony." So think about it a little bit. I promise it's relevant.
And on that note, see you guys later.
If I could, I started making a notebook of quotes too. I just had this idea from Brob now, and one of the ones I wrote down today was on the Pfister trade. They got a couple of players who weren't entirely useless. That was by Dave Cameron.
So that's me giving a compliment. Yes, if you weren't right.
And Wonder Horses.
Yeah, Wonder Horses. Yeah. That's actually how I proposed to my wife. You're not terrible. Marry me.
Well, thanks to our panel.